It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
And that is the main reason why I can't wear boxers anymore.
I really didn't need to know any of that.
I felt it was important. Anyway, hello, everyone, and welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world that was originally designed after Thunderdome. Because originally it was going to be two hosts enter, one host leaves. So we were going to fight to the death, and then next week we'd get another host with the survivor, and they would fight to the death, and every week would be that. Turns out, William and I, both incapable of landing a punch. It's not like either of us was really good at dodging. It's like, you know those things you see old-timey duels where both the guys miss, like, constantly? It's like that, except we were standing 3 feet away and throwing our fists.
Yeah, even before it started, we weren't sure why we got picked for it, but...
No, and it was a terrible plan. So, unfortunately, you'll never hear the unaired pilot where that happened, but it's mostly just, damn. Okay,
yeah,
your turn.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, I guess in a way you could say that it's still going on.
Yeah, yeah. We still haven't landed a punch.
The bout continues. Yes.
Eventually, one of us will die.
And then the other, and then someone else will be sent in.
Who will be younger, and the other one will probably be 80-something and just push him over. And
something like that.
Somebody else's podcast. Anyway.
It'll probably be more exciting then.
I'm Tony.
And I'm William, and this is episode 159.
And we're sorry about having to rely on the evil folks last week. The producer and I were actually taking a trip and had to pack and get prepared for that and stuff, so that's why that happened.
And how did that go? I mean, I don't even know anything about where you
went.
I'm
not going to tell you yet, because here's the thing. I have a lot that happened to me in the last 2 weeks, a lot of things to talk about. And something's going on next week, so we're doing two episodes tonight, so I'm going to split my how was your week stuff, but I'm going to split it chronologically. And that trip happened later.
Okay.
So that's going to come in a week for the rest of you, for you about now.
Okay.
All right, anyway, for those of you just joining us for the first time, we have a hat. It's magical. It has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. You are encouraged to email it, as are all good-hearted people.
Or bad-hearted people.
And bad-hearted people. People, email it. Our listeners like to email it with various things, questions, topics, comments, stuff like that. The hat, magic as it is, transmogrifies those emails into little note cards with the information written on them that... I lost a word. Do you ever do that? I lost a word.
Do I ever do it? I do it all the time.
Manifest.
Sometimes
manifest.
I even say the wrong word in the podcast.
Yeah, you do that a lot. I just blame that on stupidity. This was absent-mindedness. Manifest. The cards manifest physically inside the hat itself. We reach in, draw them out at random, read them on the air, talk about them till we're bored, repeat for about an hour. That's the show. Anyway, so it has been 2 weeks since we have gotten together. How have your 2 weeks been?
Well, you know, I don't really have anything to say. Just go.
We got nothing. It was 2 weeks.
Let's go right into whatever you want to talk about.
You wanted to talk about House of Cards.
Well, I thought we would last week, and I thought it was interesting that when I looked at our previous podcast, a year previous to the podcast we were going to have last week was the first mention we ever had of House of Cards in the podcast. I thought, what a coincidence. But then we ended up not doing anything last week.
But it's less of a coincidence because they're releasing one season a year, you know, kind of thing.
I suppose. But it, yeah.
It is still interesting that down to the week we managed it.
But I don't even remember what I was going to say about it. And it doesn't matter because you have, like you just said, you have a lot of stuff to talk about, so we might as well talk about that.
I've been busy. The weekend after our last not evil podcast was roller derby. Went to that with the producer, producer's sister. Ben could not make it. He was celebrating his birthday with his family. And my coworker, her soon-to-be wife, and their two friends who have sort of become regulars were also there. It was a very good game. We lost. But we made them fight for it pretty well. And the producer bought me a little tiny plastic megaphone, which everyone agreed was a terrible idea. And I got a really cool scarf, too. I'm slowly building up my collection of old Capital City Roller Girl swag.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. But that was a good game. The following Monday, which would have been a week and a half ago, was my trip to the orthopedic surgeon to check out all of my back issues. And generally speaking, everything is good.
Good.
I don't have to wear the brace anymore. I can drive the car.
Well, we already knew that much.
Did we already have that covered?
Mm-hmm.
We were trying to calculate it out. Oh, because it was... Wait.
So you haven't seen them more than once? Like, the time they told you you could drive the car and you could take off the brace, that was the last time you saw your...
Yes, but we haven't done an episode since then.
Well, we talked about it.
We talked about hoping.
No, we talked about it going well. I'm really sure we did.
Well, my appointment was on the 17th.
Yeah. It was a...
Monday.
Monday.
The following Thursday was the 20th, which is the one we skipped because today is the 27th.
Well, I thought we did talk about it. Maybe you and I talked about it, and I'm just thinking we talked about
it. We did it over email, yeah. Well, yeah, you got the email. Remember the big email where I told everybody, all my family?
Maybe that's what I'm thinking.
Yes. William's not used to the fact that he and I generally don't communicate except in front
here.
Of you guys.
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah, so, yeah, doctor said, doing pretty well. I can drive. I can walk. I can now lift up to 15 pounds instead of 5. Still can't lift Twiglet. He weighs about 19 these days. It is possible I may not end up having any physical therapy. He seems to think if we take it slow in terms of increasing activity and stuff and are careful that it may not be needed, which would be cool. He was guessing about another 6 weeks out till I can really do the gym, although I'm going to talk to him soon about maybe going to the gym just to do cardio stuff, you know, like the bike or the treadmill, because now I can stand and walk, so I could actually do the treadmill. Which I've never been able to do. Most of the nerve stuff is all working again. There's a couple little, but it's fine. It's all good now. The one issue is I appear to have a skin infection at the incision site.
Right.
So I've been keeping a dressing on that and taking some really aggressive sort of antibiotics. And that's almost over. This Monday is the end of the antibiotics course and another trip to the doctor. And hopefully that's all gone and then we're doing pretty good. I get to go back to massage therapy the week after that, so I'm very excited.
So what's it like in the morning? Are you sore?
Fine, no.
Huh.
No pain. Since the day after the surgery, that hasn't been a thing.
Wow.
The only pain I had was basically incision pain. The back pain that I suffered with for so long doesn't exist anymore.
Wow, well, that's awesome. Really good.
Yeah. I'm starting to get some pain because, I spent so long in the brace, which restricted my movement, and now I'm not having that, but I was used to regular massage therapy, and I'm not getting that for, you know, months now.
Mm-hmm.
So my body, my muscles are starting, I'm getting some stiffness in some muscles, and I'm not even exercising very much. So.
Right.
But, yeah, that'll go away soon. And hopefully, really soon, I get to start actually exercising again. Anyway. So, that's that. Saw a movie.
What'd you see?
Fargo.
That's right.
Coen Brothers film.
You told me in email that you saw it and you wanted to talk about
it. I had never seen Fargo before. I know that's sort of a lapse in some people's minds. It is on Netflix currently if other people want to watch it. Mm. I enjoyed it quite a bit. It is a very Coen Brothers film. But it might be my favorite now. The real contender is True Grit. The remake they did a few years ago.
Which was really good.
It was really, really good.
Really good.
I'm sorry to all of you out there, but Big Lebowski, while high on my list, is not my favorite Coen Brothers movie. I like it. It's not my favorite. But this one was really good, too. And I might be crazy here.
Well,
but
you might be crazy.
In what I'm about to say, specifically.
Okay.
But this movie brought something to my attention here. There are two main aspects to... Well, actually, there's a few. The producer and I discussed it later. But two ones that you can just sort of tell just by watching. Like, you could catch a chunk of a movie and know it was a Coen Brothers movie. It's horrific violence, but fairly realistic horrific violence. And a sort of surreal, regular life vibe that's not quite normal. And I realize, because that's very present in Fargo, and in fact the two are very much juxtaposed in Fargo. It's adorable and sweet and funny when it's not horrific and terrible and gruesome, like just constantly. But I realize that other, that non-horrific and terrible and gruesome side reminds me a fair bit of Wes Anderson. And that is not a comparison I would have made before, but he has that same sort of surreal, you can't quite explain why, but you're like, this doesn't feel like real life, but it you can't say why, it seems like it is, sort of thing. And now that I have that in my head, I'm going to be very curious going forward with both of them, how I see things.
Well, when it comes to the Coen Brothers and Anderson both, it is a weird thing when you're watching their films to try to really put your finger on what is going on here.
Yeah.
And not just what is it that's so different than other films, but what is it that makes it compelling?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's pretty easy to be different from what other people are doing, but to be different from what other people are doing and have it be so distinctive and compelling, I don't know. It must be in the direction. I mean, it can't just be in the script, right?
Well, but there is an issue. Like the producer pointed out, just basically every single Coen Brothers movie is about a plan, usually some sort of scheme that just goes horribly.
No. But there's lots of films like that.
Wrong.
There's lots of films like
that. That is true. I mean, it's not an unusual, but theirs are all very like. There's a very familiar narrative through all of them.
I know, but there's something about the characters. There's something about how they interact, like in Fargo. Okay. It's almost as if the Coen Brothers knew that there was something about North Dakota.
Mostly Minnesota. I think that's a terrible title for it.
No, that's
it's
true.
Almost entirely in Minnesota.
The northern climes of the U.S., Midwestern U.S., okay? There's something about that place and the people there and how they interact that if you just show it, and that's part of it. Maybe I shouldn't have said it was the directing, but the editing. You don't move the camera away. You know, the camera just stays there.
Yeah.
And you as the audience feel that silence that might take place between two people talking to each other, waiting for the other person to say something, and then they're never going to say it, and then the other person finally says, well, all right then, okay. And they go on. You know, that if you just capture that and don't turn the camera away from it or don't put anything in the script or in the direction that'll interrupt it, just let people experience it just the way it probably would happen, that's going to be interesting somehow.
Well, it's a sort of hyper-Americana in Fargo. And you got to give way credit to the performers.
No, that's right. That's another strength is they always pick people who are going to...
They're really good at casting.
Yeah, they're really good at casting.
But it
seems to me it's the...
I don't know, because here's the thing. I'm not a huge fan of them in general.
Well, I wouldn't say I am either. And
it's very mixed, but they've definitely got talent.
Well, right. And when I'm trying to think of what it is, it's... it is the performers, definitely, but it's also the camera, how they use it, and the how they edit.
Absolutely.
So it's mostly the directing and the editing coming off of that directing that is the strength. Because the script isn't, you know, there's nothing brilliant coming out of the script, really.
It's all, like I said, it's all of them are basically the same story, practically.
Now Anderson, though, there are some great script moments, I think, in Anderson.
Anderson is very clever. Anderson is very... Anderson is more avant-garde, I would say. And if rumor has it, I mean, I haven't seen, what is it, Grand Budapest Hotel or whatever.
Yeah.
If rumor has it, he has only gotten more detached from reality since Moonrise Kingdom. Apparently he's giving up with having anything that resembles reality. But yeah, he's more avant-garde, but it's the same thing. You very much feel like you're looking at a normal, sort of boring world through a very interesting lens that they've put in front of the camera. Because on paper, like if you were just to tell people the stories of Wes Anderson movies or Coen Brothers movies, they don't sound that interesting.
Or that different from a lot of other
things. They do something where you feel like I'm watching a really dull movie, but I'm on some sort of drug. So it's coming out very differently. And it makes them very insightful suddenly. You're looking at things that are very pedestrian in a whole new light. There's the damn conversation between... I mean, it's a Coen Brothers movie, so the moral ground is very tricky. But let's just say the two main villains of the film have a conversation while driving about the fact that one of them won't talk and that they're driving all these hours together even though they don't appear to know each other real well, and the other one is going crazy because he can't make conversation with this guy. And the whole thing is... it's a dull concept, but it's a really sort of fascinating conversation.
It's a very interesting
scene.
And
some of that is Steve Buscemi and Peter Stormare giving great performances,
but some of it
is the pacing and the filming.
Not like a Tarantino movie where...
No, it's not. That's the thing. It's not...
It's not these two bad guys are having a normal conversation.
No.
And now they're going to go kill a bunch of people. It's not like that. It's just...
And it's not... We take the quarter pounder with cheese thing, which is in Pulp Fiction, which is a parallel thing. That's really clever writing, and it's entertaining to listen to. Any two guys could sort of do that in a situation, and it's kind of fun. It's the equivalent of an entertaining monologue. In this case, it's an entertaining dialogue. That's not what this is.
No.
If you saw the script, you would not give a damn.
No.
It is very straightforward, pedestrian stuff, but it's very interesting and entertaining to watch.
And the fact that they're the bad guys in the movie doesn't matter.
Not at all.
The only thing that matters in this scene is they're two guys in a car driving somewhere.
And
that's all that matters.
Having an incredibly boring...
They could have been the good guys. They could have been the bad guys. They could be any two guys.
Yes.
And here they are having this conversation.
They are two guys who have been driving for 4 hours.
Yeah,
that's the important part.
That's the only important part of that scene.
They could be unrelated characters.
And yet it totally works for some reason.
It's amazing. Well, but adding the layer that you know they're the bad guys, it then lends a dimension to the entire narrative.
I suppose
that you didn't get otherwise.
I just think it's interesting how that barely
it
has
can
anything
absolutely
to do with it.
Take it. You can take it out, and it still works perfectly.
Yeah.
But when you leave it there, well, imagine the movie without that scene. Those characters are a very different life.
No, that's right. That's another thing. It's a critical scene.
Absolutely.
It's a critical, interesting scene. But it's
for no damn good reason.
No, but on every level, you're like, why is that?
Yeah.
But it's all about how it's acted and how it's shot.
And I feel like Anderson does that too. There are a lot of scenes in Wes Anderson movie that on paper don't have to be there, but are very interesting and feel very crucial. And it's not as simple as with other filmmakers where you say it's a character moment. You're getting the character. It's not as simple as that.
No, I think you're right. It's
sort
not.
Of magic.
Although
about
I do
those
think
kinds of
I
scenes.
Do think one thing you say about both directors in their work is that they're definitely more character studies than anything else. I mean, the plot and all
that other stuff
is really almost incidental. It's really about these characters, and sometimes in Wes Anderson's case, very eccentric characters in some cases.
And more so for Coen Brothers, about the relationship between the characters.
Yeah.
They're not just character studies, they're what makes it interesting is the interaction between the individuals. And for instance, what I feel about Fargo in particular is Frances McDonald's character, who I guess we could say is the lead, is fascinating because it really shows that Coen Brothers difference of this sort of hokey, comedic, sweet world and this really terrible, gruesome world, and she straddles the line, and she's the only character that really does. Some other characters sort of attempt to, and they're really bad at it. And so she becomes this incredibly sweet, kind, sort of homely badass.
Now, have you seen Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
I have not. I really need to. It's a very polarizing film amongst people I know.
Really?
And I really need to see it. People either love it or hate it.
The reason I bring it up is because you talked about the Coen Brothers having violent films. There's no violence.
Well, there's not really much in Lebowski either.
No, that's true.
But then there's stuff like you're watching True Grit, and then there's the scene with the gun in the guy's hand, and you're like, oh yeah, Coen Brothers.
Well, see, I don't think about it that way, though. I mean, there's violence in some of their films, but it always seems so part of the story.
It does, but
and then some
me,
of the films don't have any violence in them, so I don't think about it
like
that.
But Coen Brothers' violence, to me, looks a very specific way, and I can always spot it. I don't know why.
Maybe.
Like, you could essentially do the same shot with a different writer-director, and I would be able, for some reason, it's like the movie From Dusk Till Dawn, which is a shitty movie, by the way, and was directed by Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino. You can tell within a 3-second window, because they didn't collaborate. One directed one half, one directed the other. And you can tell within a 3-second window when they switched directors. We've actually done it. We've actually stopped and forwarded the frames. It's the same movie. The plot doesn't suddenly switch, but you can tell when they switch directors. And for some reason, I can tell when a violent scene is Coen Brothers. I don't know why.
Well, I don't really like Tarantino movies at all. I
grew up liking them.
I understand what other people like about them. They don't impress me. I don't think they're particularly clever or inventive or even original. But, you know, if you're into that, that's fine. I think the Coen Brothers... I think one of the ways you could recognize a Coen Brothers violent scene is because it's graphic. But I think the key here, and maybe it gets back to what I was saying about some of the ways the dialogues are shot, is the Coen Brothers keep the camera in a particular place longer than most directors would.
Yeah, yeah, I think you might be onto something there.
You know, like they let pauses happen in conversations, and even other directors who will allow that will move the camera around so that the audience doesn't get too restless, but they'll leave that camera there.
Yeah.
And in violent scenes too, they'll put the camera in the place that it's going to make the audience the most uncomfortable, and then they'll leave it there.
Yep.
And I think that's, if I had to guess, I'd say that's mostly the philosophy, is put the camera in the place that's going to cause the most cognitive dissonance with the audience, and then leave it there for longer than most people would, and that's going to have a certain effect.
And tied into it, it's very stark. Very seldom are there just violent scenes. There are very specific incidences of violence within a scene.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's always very focused. At most, two people get hurt in a scene. Like it's all very focused.
Well, and I don't think the acts themselves are particularly gratuitous. I mean,
No.
You know, they're what you would expect to happen. They're what you would expect to see if it happened. You don't have these big shootouts where a bunch of people are getting shot or whatever.
You could make the argument that they are gratuitously explicit, but I believe you just made the argument that they are, in fact, not. Or at least insofar as that is very calculated and deliberate on their part to produce an effect.
Yeah, yeah.
You could argue whether that effect is good or worthwhile or whatever, but I think it is very determined on their part and it is not pandering. It is very pointed.
If we follow this reasoning, and if I'm right about any of this, I think then what makes these films compelling is that people who watch them and like them, they somehow they get something positive, or maybe not positive, but something curious happens to them when they're forced to look at something they would normally look away from. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't know what that is. I don't know if there's something cathartic or therapeutic about that, or just something interesting like, oh, wow, when I don't turn away from this thing that I usually turn away from, I have an experience that I didn't expect to have.
The fact that it makes me think about it is a big thing for me. I have to sort of analyze my reactions to movies like that.
Yeah.
Not like that. I once saw somebody else do a remake of, sort of a remake. It was called, A Man, a Woman, and a Noodle House, I think, which was a Chinese, it was set in classical China, but it was basically a remake of Blood Simple, which I haven't seen, but I'll tell you, that movie did not feel like a Coen Brothers movie, and it wasn't, but it was their plot. You know, and then they did that with it. Okay, people. So, on behalf of my partner William and I, the balcony is now closed.
Oh, man.
Okay, so I'll talk about the other movie next week. We played with my group, and for the first time ever, we played Southeast Missouri Voluntary SWAT with the entire group.
Well, why'd you do that? I thought you only did that when someone was gone.
Because we were going, somebody was going to be gone, and it wasn't the person who was usually gone. So we're like, hey, the guy who's usually gone will finally get to play SWAT. And then it turned out the other person wasn't going to be gone, and I gave that other player the chance to pick.
Mm.
And he wanted to try it out. And I think it's a good thing. I may start incorporating it in periodically anyway. It's very cathartic. It's very... Well, at the time, I referred to it as sort of a role-playing enema. You know, we're bound up in all these stories, what's going to go on, and, oh, this part's moving sluggish in the plot, or, oh, what are we going to do here? And you play this, and it doesn't fucking matter, and you just throw whatever you want out there, and there's no lasting impact, and it just cleans you out. This particular one, they were guarding. They were guarding something on a train. They didn't know what. It was a box. The sheriff was having them guard on its trip across the state, and they were attacked by what eventually appeared to be old men in old aviator costumes flying in via multicolored hang gliders. Most of the episode involved the actual engineer of the train tied to the front of the engine and nobody going to rescue him. Even when they were in plain sight of him, there was a tremendous amount of falling down because there was a tremendous amount of struggling with the train controls and suddenly braking and suddenly speeding up.
Hang gliders,
that was how they got on the train.
Well, boy, hang gliders are not fast, you know.
No.
They must have been coming from the other direction.
Very tricky, and one got a little stuck on there. The actual passengers on the train were quite confused about who was a terrorist and who were the bad guys.
Passengers on the train.
They were passengers. There was one secure car, and then the other, it was a passenger train otherwise.
Hmm.
Luckily, one of the SWAT members is a famous actress who is researching a role. So once they figured out it was her, after they had tackled her, then they felt much better about that. and she's the only one who shot anybody and actually killed a guy due to blood loss. She's very method. The train eventually got separated into three pieces, which consisted of the engine by itself, two cars, and three cars, I think. And then, eventually... something very bad happened that caused the engine to stop. Not just, like, break, but stop dead. Which, unfortunately, gave the two other parts, which still had momentum going, a chance to slam into. While many people were standing on the roof of the next part of the train. So most people went flying. Everybody died except the SWAT members and most of the passengers. Because the SWAT members can't die. But they did eventually find out that the package in question for the sheriff was a supply of, due to last time's issues, now hard to get cocaine. which the sheriff has developed a bit of a crutch for, given it was in the water supply and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So they were not super pleased about that. But in general, everybody had a fun time.
But in general, everybody had a fun time. Yes. Wish you were here.
Ah, it got a little crazy. So yeah, that was fun. And next week, read last week, the producer and I are going to Michigan for 4 days. And I think it might be a very interesting trip. Also, we might see another movie.
You did go to Michigan already, though.
Yes, I know, but I'm not talking about it.
Fine.
We're already halfway.
I don't know anything about it, that's why I want...
I know.
You didn't tell me anything.
Whereas when I tell you stuff, you're like, you already talked about that. Don't talk about it on the podcast.
No, I'm not saying don't talk about it. I'm saying you already talked about it. But you didn't in this case, so that's fine.
All right, I will tell you something I learned from my trip in Michigan. It's a limerick.
Okay.
All right. Stick with me here. There once was a man from Japan whose poetry no one could scan. When asked all about it, he said, "I don't doubt it. I always try to cram as many syllables into the last line as I possibly can."
Gotcha. That's great.
It's good, and it's clean. It's fun for the whole family. I like it. It's good.
It might be a little racist.
No, it's a rhyme scheme. It only becomes racist if you do it in a voice. And you'll note, I did not do it in a voice.
You know what I'm thinking about right now?
Listeners at home, don't do it in a voice.
I'm thinking about how Coen Brother films have probably been analyzed to death, so our analysis...
On this episode.
No, just in general, we probably sound really pedestrian talking about it.
I feel awful pedestrian. I also feel pedantic, and I'll tell you why.
Why?
We use the word pedestrian like 4 times so far in this episode. We're kind of douchebags. Anyway, hat. I hope there's something in here.
There always is. It's the hat.
I know.
I hope there's something in here. Azure Talon.
Azure Talon. Now, the critical question, how many exclamation points after his name?
3.
Damn it.
Dear dissonant and confused forced voices of the magical talking hat. What are you most grateful for?
I'm most grateful that I assume there's a finite number of these that you put in here. I know you field this one.
Why is that?
You seem like a grateful kind of guy.
I am, but I don't want to sound
ungrateful.
No, I don't want to sound like a jerk or anything, but I don't know if I think of the things I'm grateful for as there are some things I'm most grateful for. You know what I'm saying? I'm grateful for all of it pretty much the same. There's not anything that I'm grateful for that I'm less grateful for than something else.
So you are equally grateful for veggie hot dogs, and for your family.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm particularly grateful for veggie hot dogs to begin with.
I'm grateful for non-veggie.
See,
hot dogs.
The thing is, maybe that's another thing is that.
Remember that time.
I'm neutral about just about everything in the world except the most important things, and I'm grateful for those.
Remember that time when President George W. Bush confused the word grateful with gracious, and he's trying to express his gratitude, and he's like, "My wife and I are so gracious." We're all so gracious.
And you're grateful for that moment?
A little bit.
I'm grateful for the things most people are grateful for. I'm grateful for my family and my, you know, a lot of experiences I've had that I think have been important, you know, to me in my life. I'm grateful for you. I'm grateful for this podcast. There's a lot of things to be grateful for in life. I think everybody, if they sat and thought about it for just a little bit, they'd realize that they have a lot of things to be thankful for.
I sat and thought about it and thought about something else entirely.
That you're grateful for?
No, that's what I mean. Entirely different. Something I forgot to talk about from the week because it was so far back.
Okay. Well, as long as you're grateful about it, then...
I kind of am.
Good.
I watched The Room for a second time.
Oh, yeah?
This time sober, and this time by myself.
Okay.
Last time, if you'll recall, it was over New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
I was super drunk, and there were a lot of people, most of whom were pretty drunk, all yelling at the screen and making jokes. This time I watched it alone, sober, on my computer. And it was amazing.
Was it more amazing than when you were drunk?
Sort of. Mm. And here's why. You cannot prep anyone for this movie. You try, but you can't. You can't understand until you see it. You can say, this movie is just terrible. Absolutely terrible. And you're like, okay, I get that. You go, no, you are not prepared. Ever. But when you watch it a second time, you've done it. You know, you're prepared for this. And so you notice things that you didn't notice the first time because you were too busy going, what? And the stuff that I'm like, I really got confused. Well, maybe I was drunk. I can check, you know, you can pay more attention in this scene to see if maybe it makes a little more sense than it might have. And here's the thing. I have never said this about a film. I did not think it was possible to say this about a film. I'm going to. I saw the movie when I was drunk with a bunch of people yelling at the screen. There were a lot of things, let's just say the entire film, that confused me. That didn't make sense. When I watched it this time, sober, alone, paying attention, absolutely, absolutely nothing makes more sense. Nothing is cleared up in the slightest. New questions are asked in some cases. New things I didn't notice before that I still don't know why the fuck are like that. There's a scene where one of the actors sits on the floor behind a couch, like the couch is between him and the camera. And he's not, like, he and another actor are engaged in the only they're the only ones on screen. And he sits down on the floor to finish the conversation.
Behind the couch.
Behind the couch.
Outside of view of the camera.
Yes. I think maybe they cut to, and there's no story reason whatsoever. I mean, and there's a couch there he could sit on. I noticed that weird things, like there is a completely superfluous scene, as all of them are, set in the coffee shop, where two of the characters go to talk for like 30 seconds for no reason, before one of them quickly has to leave. In the process of this, they set it up to be realistic by having three sets of customers before our heroes, who place orders. Also, when they sit down with their drinks, a staff member, even though they already, oh, I guess maybe brings them their drinks, and asks if they want anything to eat, and makes a suggestion. All of the people ordering also order, they order, it's coffee shop, so they order some sort of beverage, and they order some sort of food. In every case, each of the three sets of customers, and the suggestion made by the thing, is cheesecake. Apparently this coffee shop, beverages and cheesecake. And that is it. Nobody else. Nothing else. After I watched it the second time, I watched the meme video of Hitler watching it.
Okay.
Hitler and I found many similar problems. He noticed the sitting on the floor thing. He noticed that the female lead with bright blonde hair could not be bothered to dye her eyebrows, which are dark brown.
But that's not too unusual, really. I've seen that a lot in just people walking down the street.
Which
mystifies me, I have to admit.
Basically, every emphasis, every, like, syllable emphasis in the movie is wrong. Everywhere. I noticed that people show up at places to see people, and those people say, I can't talk to you right now, I have to go, and then offer them a drink. I noticed that one of the main characters constantly says, I don't want to talk about it, on various topics. Half of the time, she having brought them up two sentences earlier herself. people frequently show up just to tell people they're too busy to stay. all the conversations are in real time, so people never hang out together for longer than 2 minutes. Ever. It's amazing. I'm grateful. Stuff I'm grateful for. I'm really grateful for my back surgery. That's a thing I'm very recently grateful for.
Yeah.
It is literally a life changer for me. It is fixing stuff that I have dealt with for a long time and that I just kind of assumed at this point I was going to deal with forever.
Yeah.
I am grateful to have married somebody who makes way more money than me. I'm grateful to be this good looking.
I'm grateful for our listeners. I know that sounds corny, but it's true.
I'm grateful for all but three of our listeners, but I refuse to specify which of the three.
I'm grateful.
If you think
for all
you're the one, you're not the one. Well, okay, you. Not, no. To the left. Yeah, you. I'm not grateful. I can already guess which listeners think I'm talking about. That's hilarious. Anyway.
Is there something you feel like you're most grateful for more than anything else?
The producer. Unquestionably.
Yeah.
That has come up more recently. I was just thinking about it last night as I was going to bed, actually. This might sound like a weird sentiment, but it just, as I was going to bed, it sort of articulated in my brain. And to some people, this may sound even terribly unhealthy, and you have to sort of understand me and her and our marriage to know how I mean it, I guess. But when I am finished living, I hope that people understand, and I'm not going to have a tombstone, I'm going to be cremated, but it would be on there if it was, that Trish was the point. I have learned that over recent years, and I'm very happy about that.
Yeah.
But she's the reason I'm doing all this, by which I mean existence.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm definitely most grateful for her. And we're coming up on our 10th anniversary, so
yeah.
It seemed apt
yeah.
as well. But, I mean, I'm grateful for just about everybody I encounter in a day, everyone I have. I'm grateful for people in general. I'm grateful for my ability to avoid people when I want to. I'm grateful for elastic waists. Grateful for... Don't we have an episode called Grateful for Something?
I don't know. I don't remember.
I think we do.
I don't remember that.
I don't remember what it was, though. Grateful for something. All I know is we're so gracious.
Well, I've been really fortunate in my life. I mean, you know, I've probably talked often on the podcast about my family and my upbringing. You know, I've got four siblings, and I was very close to my parents. I never even went through a period with my parents where we weren't close.
I can't remember. Meltzer or Dallas, which one are you grateful for and which one are you not? The producer and I were trying to work this out the other day. We can't remember which one's the bad one.
The bad one? There isn't a bad... Well...
Which one would your father say is the bad one?
Meltzer.
Meltzer. Okay. See, I got confused. I thought you guys were Meltzer and Dallas were the bad ones, but you guys were Dallas.
Well, it's complicated when the Wrights first moved into the area, they lived in Dallas Township, but they lived south of Meltzer, and they went to the Methodist Church in Meltzer, not the Methodist Church in Dallas.
Okay.
And Dad was born down there, too.
All right.
But it's just a matter of, for my dad, it's a matter of, well, the Dallas side was more of the farmers and the Methodist Church there Congregational church. There wasn't a Catholic church or a Lutheran church in town, and I don't think they ever had any taverns on their main street or anything, and that was mostly where the farmers lived. And Meltzer is where the newer immigrants, Catholic, Lutheran, there were like six taverns in that one tiny little town, you know, that kind of thing. And so I think Dallas seems more Methodist to Dad than Meltzer did or something like that. It's hard to really put my finger on.
The town of Meltzer over there, too many Lutherans.
No, what?
That's something you've never, ever heard in life.
But
nobody's ever concerned because of an abundance of Lutherans.
Well, okay,
some Catholics in a certain century might.
You have to keep in mind the distinction here is there's some, of course, there's doctrinal differences, obviously. But I mean, if you go to the Congregational Church or the Methodist Church and you have communion, you have grape juice. If you go to the Lutheran Church or the Catholic Church, if you have Mass at Catholic Church or communion at the Lutheran Church, it's real wine. So, I mean, that
as near as I can tell, that's Lutheran's only vice, so you
kind of
got to give it to him.
Well, but also,
Lutherans
are basically
Gandhi that drinks.
I'm sure that, again, a lot of the people who lived in Melcher who were Catholic or Lutheran were more recent arrivals to the United States, whereas, you know, the people in Dallas came from Ohio and places where their families had been for a long time. And they were mostly farmers, not miners, not coal miners. Mm-hmm. That was a big thing in Melcher and Dallas was coal mining. So there was just that it was the same kind of conflict you get like in New York, you know, when the Irish people came and they were new and they were taking everybody's jobs. It's this very similar thing. Like
now
that.
Here, privately between you and me, I get what you're saying. But I don't know that I would go around explaining that other places. Because you kind of make your dad sound like racist.
Well, not really racist.
No, I get it. I get it. I'm just saying keep it between you and me. Because I feel like what you don't explain it well to other people. So we'll keep this private, okay? Don't tell anybody. Shh.
I wasn't really talking about my dad. I was talking about the differences between Melcher and Dallas. And what I'm saying is that for my dad, what it comes down to, it really doesn't have anything to do with whether a person's from... You know, Croatia or whatever else. It has to do with, you know, for my dad, it's really mostly comes down to there are no bars in Dallas, but there are a ton of bars in Melcher. That's really what it comes down to for my dad. That has nothing to do with someone's being from Czechoslovakia or something like that, or even if they're Catholic or Lutheran. Doesn't matter. It's mostly the drinking thing.
I feel like you could modify the "There Are No Cats in America" song from American Tale. To be like, there are no bars
but it's,
in Dallas.
It's not racist.
And the streets are lined with cheese.
And he doesn't care what church you go to or what country you come from. But he does care about the drinking thing a little bit. I mean, he doesn't care. If you drink, that's your business. But, you know, he's not going to go live in a town where there's a bunch of bars because he doesn't want
to
deal with a bunch of drunk people.
Is
what it comes down to. Dad. He's funny.
What I want to know is why he was concerned that the streets were lined with cheese. That seems like a weird thing for a human male, older gentleman to be concerned with. I haven't seen that movie in so long.
It is hard,
you
really.
You think it holds up? You think an American Tale holds up?
I don't know. It is hard to explain to people the whole, you know, because as soon as you tell people that you come from a background that's like old-time Methodist conservative, they immediately make a lot of assumptions about how you felt about other people who weren't like you.
Yes, they do.
Which isn't fair because that's not how we were raised.
You silently judging me all the time.
Well, but that's... We were...
Okay, I lied. You never are silent.
We were raised a certain way, but we were also raised to respect how other people live their lives and to not judge people for that. And that, you know, and that's the way we are. So it's kind of not fair for people to think that about us.
I feel like I was raised... to have an open mind, and I feel like I have since rebelled against that because, and I'm going to be honest, people, judging others is fun. I'm not saying it's right, I'm not saying it's accurate, it's just entertaining. And most of you are smoking too many cigarettes, so stop it. See, that was fun for me. All right, let's do another question. This one's gotten out of hand. I am grateful that we have another question in here to talk about. Maybe.
I'm grateful for a lot of things. I think about that every day, what things I'm grateful for.
Seriously, we have an episode called Grateful for Something, and it's something weird. Go figure. This one is from Craig. I feel like there's like 3 or 4 people that we get all our questions from, though.
Yeah.
So you guys better keep writing, or else I don't know what we're going to do. And the rest of you, you know, get on the stick. Which is a term, by the way. I don't understand why. That's a thing. Get on the stick. like to, I don't, I have no idea why.
On the stick.
Get on the stick.
Yeah, get on the stick.
It conjures horrible images.
For you, maybe.
But I don't get to.
I can understand why it would for you.
But what is it? I don't know.
Well, I don't know what it's in reference to, but it just makes me think of Pilot, for example.
Oh, if you have to tell a pilot that, they're a pretty shitty pilot. Like, what are they doing? Like, hanging out in the back? It's doing sock puppet shows or what?
I don't know.
Like, the expression should just be, fly the plane before you kill us.
I don't think that's what it's from, but that's what it makes me think
of. That would make the most sense of all the ideas I have, which is basically that one. I don't know another stick that one would get on. Put
a broomstick?
Put your ankles into... Yeah. Get moving, witch. Turn some people into frogs. WGN is making a TV show all about Salem witch trials, but that's gonna have actual, like, witches and, like, spooky shit and stuff. I can't decide if I really want to watch it or I really want to never go near it. The trailers are really sort of vague. Anyway, this is from Craig, as I said before. Craig, who at this point might be our entire international contingent. If there's others of you out there listening or still listening, Stephen Gerwick, if you are, let us know. Go to the blog, themagicaltalkinghat.com, and tell us. Or write the hat, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, and say your own shit, and then we'll talk about it on the air. It'll be fun. Anyway, dear Tony and William, do you play any musical instruments? Did you used to? I feel like we've had this one covered, too. You played what, trombone?
No.
Something nerdy as shit. Didn't you play something? You were in pep band. You
played
something.
Was there anything not nerdy to play in band? What's cool to play in band?
Saxophone was what everybody thought was cool to play in band.
Really?
It is not cool to play in band. But
my recollection
was the
80s. Just being in band wasn't cool.
Well, that is true.
Being in a band, like a rock band, was cool.
Yeah.
Kind of cool.
I feel like trombone is sort of, you know, like, least among equals kind of thing.
No, I was a flute player.
Flute, really?
Played the flute, yeah.
Oh, the producer played the flute.
As far as I know, I was the only male flute player in Iowa.
That's a thing. I, for the 2 weeks I played flute, was the only male. And throughout my schooling, I don't recall seeing another one.
Took piano lessons and didn't catch on to it very well. When I was introduced
it's
to...
It's probably the eight fingers.
No, I'm not coordinated is what it comes down to.
You don't have enough fingers.
And when I was introduced to an instrument in fourth grade, that's when they introduced people to band instruments.
Yeah.
I wanted to play the saxophone, but reed instruments, I couldn't... I mean, I could get them to make a sound, but the reed vibrated so much it hurt my lip, and I couldn't figure out how to not do that. I didn't have any interest in the brass instruments at all. And I wasn't particularly interested in the flute, but I could play it, which a lot of people couldn't, you know.
No, I had trouble with
the transverse flute, you blow over the hole and whatever. So it's what I could play, and it was a woodwind instrument, which I preferred. My first choice was to play percussion. But my mom...
was having none of it.
Well, she thought I should play something more melodious.
Than percussion? That makes sense. I would see you as a percussionist in secondary school. I would totally.
And for some reason, I thought that was a good suggestion, so I followed that suggestion.
It's harder to be a solo drum act.
And it turned out I was pretty good at playing the flute. When I went to state, I was second chair, which, you know, was pretty good, I guess, for state. I don't play the flute anymore. I've switched to, like, the tin whistle, the Irish whistle, and I play that, and I like to play that. But
you play guitar, don't you?
I can't play it very fast. Well, also in high school, eventually I was a drum major, and I did play percussion. I played xylophone and bells. I was also in jazz band. I played the bass guitar.
Okay.
But I've since forgotten how to do that, and I don't play that anymore. But I did play bass in jazz band, and I played...
I thought I saw a thing of you playing guitar for, like, a Pilot House video or something.
No.
Who was that?
I don't know. We've never made a video.
Probably Matthew McConaughey.
But I can play a lot of things on the Irish whistle, but nothing fast. I'm not very good at playing fast. Yeah. Again, the coordination problem. And mostly, when it comes to music, I've been a vocalist and I write lyrics and whatever. Sometimes some of the songs that me and my friend Chris have come up with, I had the idea for the song and I basically told him what he should play on whatever instrument that he's playing, because he plays them all. And so I've composed some songs and things like that, but nowadays as a musician, I mostly just, you know, play whistle type flutes only. And I mean, I don't really sing very much anymore either. My vocal quality was never very good, so we never attracted a very large number of fans. I mean, I don't have a voice that you'd hear on Idol or something, and that's what people want to hear. So
I don't know. William Hung got on Idol.
Well, you either have to have a voice
singing "She Bangs."
You either have to sing like the Idol people, or you have to have your voice has to be interesting in some other way,
like Tom Waits, and yeah. You don't drink or smoke,
no.
So
or even like say David Bowie or something. No, yeah. I mean there's my voice is right in the middle of those two extremes, which is completely boring and uninteresting. I mean, Chris and I have often talked. Well, I've talked about. I think he.
If you're hearing some weird noises, people, it's raining quite heavily outside, and there's a little pinging going off the air conditioning unit next to us.
For one thing, I think he's okay with my voice, but another thing is, I think he feels like I'm just being hard on myself. But I've often thought, you know, it would be good if we found a good female vocalist to sing our songs, because a lot of our songs, a female vocalist would do really well.
I will admit, you make a bad female vocalist.
But that's...
As opposed to, say, Adam Levine.
But, I mean, it's I'm playing the whistle on some of the songs that we have. I mean, if you go out to Pilot House on SoundCloud, you can hear me singing and playing, singing songs that I wrote the lyrics to. But that's the extent of my... I mean, I guess you could say I'm a musician of sorts, even still a little bit. But I don't know what your background is with music.
I feel like I discussed this before.
Well, I don't feel like I said all that before. I might have said something.
No, I don't feel like you said all that before either, but I feel like I said 3 years of piano in my primary school days. In fourth grade, I started on bass, big upright double bass. Mm-hmm. For reasons I still don't understand to this day, orchestra began in fourth grade. Band did not begin until fifth grade. When fifth grade came around, as luck would have it, the rehearsals were at the exact same time. So I tried, I went and did flute, but I had been doing a year of bass, so I wasn't going to stop. And it became painfully obvious that when I was only going to every other rehearsal for the two, it wasn't working and I had to pick, so I stuck with the one I had done for a year already. So I played the flute for 2 weeks. And I played the bass for... 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, half of 8th. And then at that point, I was requested and agreed to switch to viola. Because as luck would have it, at the time we were down to one viola in our orchestra. So I agreed to learn viola. And I play viola. And that was it for instruments. Mostly I was a vocalist. 5th and 6th grade I was in the choir. All through high school I was in choir. 3 of those years I was in the swing choir, our version of like jazz choir or show choir. I was in a bunch of musicals. I took private vocal lessons for 2-3 years in there. I did a little bit of singing in college, but not much. I joined sort of a college/community choir for one semester, but that was it. And so mostly, yeah, vocalist, and then since then I really haven't done anything. I have often felt I would, have been very good as a percussionist. I feel like I have a good sense of rhythm. I frequently drum. When that's my response to listening to music is frequently drumming along. I have enjoyed just drum circles and stuff that I've done before. I own some skin drums, and I have done that. I also kind of wish I had taken up the cello. I am a big fan of the cello, I have discovered. But yeah, that's it. So I played all those instruments. I don't really play any of them anymore. I couldn't figure out if I tried at this point.
I was terrible in choir. I couldn't sing parts or anything. I was really bad at that. I was the lead in a musical when I was in fifth grade, and I sang in a church cantata, but only because they needed a soloist for a particular song, and nobody else, they didn't think anybody else could do it.
Had that range.
So I sang that particular song and tried my best to, I don't remember even which part they put me in to sing for everything else, and I wasn't very good at that. But I sang the solo they wanted, and that was fine. And otherwise, I wasn't in the choir because I was just never good at that kind of thing.
And because you were busy playing the trombone?
No, I was good at playing the xylophone and the bells and various percussion. But when it comes to like playing a trap set, again, the coordination thing comes into it, and I can't really do that. Yeah. But playing one thing, like you said, keeping rhythm on just one drum, or playing bells or xylophone or something, that's different.
Cowbell.
That I can handle, but...
Did you ever get a fever, and the only cure was more cowbell?
No.
That's too bad. All right, we should wrap this up, because we have to do another one in a minute. So, for you guys, this will be a week. For us, it'll be like 10 minutes. In the meantime... The balcony is closed. I wonder if we're going to get sued.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.